Hello, everyone. I'm Robbie Dorman, and this is the Serial Fanaticist, the podcast for fans of everything. Welcome. Today, I am joined by Andrew Bloom of theandrewblog.net to talk about the first season of The Haunting of Hill House. We talk about the ending of the season, the dynamics of the family, the Crane family, and the effectiveness of its scares. There are spoilers contained within, so don't listen if you haven't watched. This show is the best kind of adaptation, and it was a great time talking to Andrew about it. On to the discussion! Hello, everyone. I'm here once again with Andrew Bloom. We're going to talk about some Haunting of Hill House today. Andrew, how are you doing?
I'm doing very well, Robbie. I suddenly feel very well adjusted and well connected to my various family members and decidedly reassured that there's no haunting figures lurking under my bed or behind the closet or stalking me down the street. So it's positive. Thumbs up.
No bent neck ladies?
No bent neck ladies. All the ladies I know and have interacted with have had relatively straight necks.
Normal neck ladies. Haunting of Hill House on Netflix, season one, premiered October 12th. It was a Halloween, just in time for Halloween, so we're a little bit late, but that's fine. We're very rarely right on top of things. I don't know. I didn't know what to expect from it. I avoided most reviews. I only heard like, oh, it's good. That was the reviews, the hype I'd heard from Twitter and elsewhere. But I had not read any real reviews. I had really no idea what was going to be happening in the show. I'm familiar with Shirley Jackson's work. This is definitely not, this is extraordinarily tangential to Shirley Jackson.
I was going to say, the only thing I knew about it was that I'd heard the same things. It was a good quality television show. But as I mentioned to you, I'd also heard it compared to Hereditary, one of the great films of 2018 that is also horror in a similar vein. So that gave me kind of an idea what to expect, though I think at the end of the day, they're pretty different.
I believe I saw a headline after I finished watching. I combed through some reviews and I saw a headline, "Eat Your Heart Out, Hereditary, Haunting the Hill House is the show, the thing about blah, blah, blah."
Those people are wrong.
I haven't seen Hereditary yet.
They're both good, but those people are wrong.
I haven't seen Hereditary yet. It's on my list of things, but after watching this, I might need to take a break from doom and gloom and horror. Because there is a haunted house in it. I think that's where it kind of begins and ends with the connection to Shirley Jackson. And the film adaptation from the 60s? Is that one of the Haunting of Hill? The movie came out? I think so.
Is that the one with Vincent Price?
I think so. I've never seen the movie. I've always heard it was very moody and good, that I've never, I don't know, older horror that just doesn't really do much for me a lot of the time.
I think I may be mistaking it for House on Haunted Hill, which I feel like is a fair confusion to make.
Yeah, that's the other thing. There is also multiple. There's a remake of House on Haunted Hill that had Owen Wilson. And no Wilson Fisk's. Daredevil got canceled. I don't know if you heard.
I did.
He'll be in Spider-Man 3 or whatever. But I heard it was good. And I saw that this got Mike Flanagan, the director, the creator of the show. I don't think he directed all the episodes, but he's the showrunner.
Directed most of them, I want to say.
Did he?
I think so.
I saw that he did the Stephen King movie, the adaptation, Gerald's Game, which I've not watched yet. So that was interesting. But then I also saw he did Ouija, Origin of Evil, which I believe I saw multiple reviews of that film calling it one of the worst things ever made. So I was a little bit concerned about this thing. But overall, good? Good.
I think good is fair. I think I fell into the, like, good, not great. Does a lot of things that I really like. Does also a decent number of things that I had some issues with. But in the balance, felt like a good show. A show I was glad to have watched, even if it didn't touch my life in any particular way. Just probably a little more than one can expect from a TV show.
It touched your life at all?
I mean, it touched my life in that I spent time, hours of my life watching it, where I could otherwise have presumably been doing different things. So
that's very true.
To that extent, yes. But I didn't walk away from it a changed man, suddenly willing to confront my demons rather than turn away from them like some wall-putting-up guy.
Oh, God. I didn't quite get the metaphor when they explained it three times in a row on the show, so maybe you could explain it to me again. And
Robbie, maybe you were putting up a wall against metaphors.
Oh, God. It's a little heavy-handed there at the end about making us understand what things are about. I get it, guys. You don't have to... You don't have to literally have your characters repeat the lessons that we learned three times prior. Oh, and we saw that dude hidden in the walls, and then we had a ghost lady explain it one more time, and then we had one more time where we tried to, okay, I get it, the walls, we're putting up walls between family members, I understand.
Well, I'm sorry they had to repeat themselves, Robbie, but it'll help you remember.
Help me remember. I think that's the thing that keeps it from being great, is that when it's not, I think the show is best when it's not worried about ghosts, at least not like literal ghosts.
I would agree with that. I think it's a better family drama than it is a horror story at the end of the day, though I like a decent amount of the horror things that it does.
I mean, I think I just think there should be less horror versus like cadre of ghosts stalking people down hallways and stuff. You know, the light touches, I think when the show is subtle, it's good. And even I think broaching on great at times when it's subtle, but other times it is terribly unsubtle. And then I think might be even less than good. And it makes me roll my eyes a little bit. I go, oh, okay, guys, I get it. I don't... And the jump scares.
There was only one, what I would consider like a traditional jump scare. Was there not? Were there multiple ones?
I mean, there was one big one. But there was other ones that are just like, a thing moves real fast right at you. Or there is a big noise at a very specific time, and I think the horror in the show is most effective when it is encroaching slowly and letting the realizations of things happen to us without throwing a big scary girl in our face.
I would agree with that. I think the show is a lot better at atmospheric horror than it is at doing specific scares. It's very good at letting you kind of feel the creep of something encroaching upon the safe areas that the Crane family enjoys, but it's not as good at just like, oh, whoa, here's a weird scary thing and it's coming at you now.
And those are the parts of the thing that kind of demonstrate. It's why I hate most modern horror movies. Like, I hate so... They're so bad. Like, they're so... Like, it's just a bunch of things skulking around, and then a jump scare, and then more skulking, and then a jump scare for 90 minutes, and then it's over. And the scary thing in the end is, like, a girl with a big mouth that opens... It's like a ghost that's a girl, and she's, like, wearing a white dress, and she has black hair. She looks like the Ring ghost, because they all do. And then their mouth opens real wide and they go, ah, and we go, oh no. And everyone screams and runs away. I'm at least glad that all the actual ghosts of this are varied. They have interesting design in them.
I mean, I guess you do still have at least one of those Ring girl-esque ghosts in the form of, before I go any further, we're for everybody listening at home, spoilers galore.
Yeah, absolutely. You go watch the show before you listen to this if you don't want to know everything about it, if you care. Nell herself is kind of...
Yes.
Kind of like... I mean, I don't know. That's a...
How is she not? Especially before they reveal that it's her and they use all the massive hair to try to hide that what her identity is and put her in the big flowing gown.
I think I can forgive all of that because I think that her episode 5, I think it was, I think it's my favorite episode of all of them. Maybe five or six is probably my two favorites. They're right in the middle. And because I think her story works so well up to that. I guess it's a reveal. The reveal of, oh, she was the Bentneck lady all along. And her, like, that is, I felt that was very effective and something I did not see coming, at least not, and especially not in the way that they shot it. So I really like that. Like, that's the other thing. Like, for all the, like, very kind of standard tropey ways they, wherever they put the camera is, a lot of times it's just like, oh god, whenever there's a character in the foreground and there's a huge space of just emptiness, I'm like, something's gonna walk past. I know, like, you do, and they do it so many times. I just watched 10 episodes of this. I know there's a thing gonna be there. I get it. Or, oh, you're gonna fake me out, not put a thing there, and then there's a thing on the other side, and it goes, but the hell was I talking about? Episode 5, I don't mind the fact that they give her the, you know, creepy ring girl look, because it does lead, it means something in the end. It leads up to, oh, it was her. It's like it works. It builds to that in a very, and I think it's not just a reveal to spook us, like a momentary scare. Oh no, look, she's creepy. It's like that episode, the show in a total, it does a very good job of dissecting these people's psychosis, and at least as much as a 10 episode show can, that's a horror movie.
That's the proviso I add to everything I do. This was a pretty good, Eggs Benedict for a 10 episode horror movie.
Exactly. But the fact that that's at the end of her episode, after we see genuine character growth and genuine character arc, and we understand where she is, you know, because this is after she's already dead. She's committed suicide in episode, what, 2? And
episode 1.
Was it the end of 1? I can't even...
Yeah.
So that's episode 5. We finally figure out, oh, that's why she didn't... Well, one, she didn't really kill herself. Sorta. We don't know yet. We're not sure. And... let me ask you this. This is because it's a thought that crossed my mind. Was there ever a point in the show where you thought they're going to say there's no ghosts at all? This is all just people with mental illness?
I definitely was concerned about that. Because of comparisons to some other works that I'd seen that kind of draw out the same idea. And B, because Steven so many times goes, no, Dad, you don't understand. This is mental illness. Why didn't you do something? Words about this, that you felt like they were going somewhere with it. Even if it turned out to just be like, oh, it might all be in their heads, but it turns out it's actually ghosts. Yeah. It felt like they were going for almost a double fake out there, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And I think there's some confusion, I think, at points, and it muddies the water. Like, I understand why they did it. I think, in fact, at the end, they have to do it that way, because that's part of the idea. But it also ends up muddying the water at certain points, because I'm never sure. At a certain point, I'm never sure if what they're seeing are real ghosts or not real ghosts. I've read an interview where they're like, yeah, we purposely did that. We're like, because Shirley sees a quote-unquote ghost, but it's just a memory of the dude that she had an affair with. He's not a ghost. I assume that guy's still alive somewhere.
I mean, I guess I took those kinds of scenes to be the house or the spirit or whatever it is that is orchestrating all of this, using things to try to lure and unravel the Crane children to make them feel like they have to go back to the house.
Right.
So if he's not a ghost, he's a manifestation of the house, or
yeah,
the evil that lurks within it, or the power that lurks within it.
I don't know. Were you expecting an answer about the house, about what it is?
Not really. If anything, I feel like I would have been disappointed if we would have gotten one, because it would make the one of the things that I appreciated about the show is that the power and what the house did and why it was doing it was kind of unknowable and inscrutable in some ways. And you can chalk that up to easy writing to some extent, but I also think it makes it feel more mysterious and more spiritual and a little different, to where saying, oh, it turns out it's an Indian burial ground, or it turns out that, you know, Satan himself was born within these walls, would cheapen it in some way.
I mean, the Satan houses, you got to watch out. You got to ask the real estate agent.
Legally, they have to disclose that.
Yeah, you not necessarily have to disclose dead bodies, as we learn in the show, but Satan houses, absolutely.
Did you, Robbie, expect that they were going to explain the house at some point?
I think I expected it. I didn't necessarily want an answer, because all the things you just said, but it being unknowable is probably better in the long run, because then they can just focus on the family. Apparently, they were going to have like 5-minute segments at the beginning of every episode that was basically reading from Steve's book that would discuss the history of the house, but they ran out of money, so they didn't do that.
To have a 5-minute excerpt of Steve reading his book, or were they going to show scenes of
house? I assume they would be showing us scenes of all those characters that, you know, the dude that was up in the dude that was in the wall, the flapper girl who was insane, and her husband who's also insane, the old decrepit late, like all those ghost characters that we barely, aside from the hell is that girl, the flapper, what's her,
Poppy.
I was like, it's Poppy, but that's not a person's name. Why would you? What is Poppy short for?
Poppy.
Okay, her name is just Poppy.
Poppinza? I don't know.
Poppy Hill.
Maybe it's a nickname.
Her name is Poppy Hill. Where's the propane in this show? That's my true question. Where's Hank? Where's Hank and Peggy and Bobby?
It is the strangest crossover between King of the Hill and Frasier that I could ever have imagined.
God. It does look like Maris's mansion. Family there. the Gothic mansion. I don't know. I think it's better off just focusing on the family, because I think that's what the show is about. But ultimately, I think that's my other complaint, is I think the ending... I felt kind of muddled there. Not even the ending, but like the last episode. It felt kind of muddled. It felt like I thought I knew what the show was about, and then it was kind of like, oh, the show's about loving each other. I'm like, is it? I thought it was about like belief and mental illness and like family in traumatic trauma, basically living, you know, past. There's no expiration date on trauma. That's what I really was like, thought, oh, this is what the show is like putting on me. I'm like, that's all right. And then at the end, it's just like, no, dad kills himself, so we're all fine now. I'm like, mm-hmm. And then there's that folk song with the banjos.
You're going to have to be more specific. No, I know what you mean. Here's the thing about the ending. It's a complete patchwork quilt of different ideas stitched together, trying to nail the landing on this thing, to mix a metaphor. And I agree, it doesn't come out very clear, and it doesn't come out very impactful because of that. It does feel very muddled. I think the best thing you can say about the show, at least in terms of what it's about, is that it's about the complications of family and how the things, you know, what is the, every family is happy. Every happy family is happy in the same way, but every sad family is sad in their own way. I'm butchering that quote, but you know what I'm referring to there. That there's a peculiar thicket of interrelations between the Cranes that have made their lives hard individually and have made their connections to one another very frayed and very difficult. And that the show as a whole is about them confronting those things when they would rather turn away from them, pushing through them, and getting better on the other side. I feel like that's what the ending is trying to say. And I think it's a fair read of the show as a whole that it's trying to say that, even if it spends more time focusing on the difficulty of those tangles than on the actual pushing through of them. But at the same time, it's so vague at the end, and there's so many shortcuts narratively to get the characters from entering these Faustian bargain scenes to, like, everybody's happy and cutting cake together, that it doesn't feel satisfying. It doesn't feel like a meaningful capstone to what the show had done for those previous 9 episodes. It's there. I don't think the ending comes out of nowhere, but I also don't think there's a perfect level of connective tissue between episodes 1 through 9 and where the show goes in episode 10.
Yeah, I don't like the fact that Olivia Liv is basically the villain at the end.
I don't think she's the villain.
She's trapped. Well, she's trapped. She made her kid inject rat poison into himself. I don't think that's a good thing.
She's the antagonist. I mean, I'm not sure I'd even go that far. She's certainly a force acting in opposition to what we would want for the characters. But I think the show has a lot of sympathy for her and presents her as a disturbed person who wants to be with her children.
I think that's where I depart from the show, in that I didn't, like, I had plenty of sympathy for her until the point where she's feeding kids rat poison. And then I go, I don't have that. Like, there was a certain point where someone is so damaged that they are a danger to other people. And I mean, I think that is the question the show raises to a certain extent about mental illness, and like how much the other, like an addiction that, because despite the fact that Luke is the one that's like kind of ostracized for his addiction problems, they all are addicted to something. They all cope with through different mechanisms. He just happened to choose heroin. But it's that point where it's like, that was a, it's past the point of no return for me. Like, I can't feel sympathy for her anymore. She's poisoning children. And like, maybe the show is just pushing. I don't know if that's universal or not. It might just be me, but I can't, at a certain point you go, Mom, that's not my mother anymore. There is nothing, there's no part of her anymore that is my wife or mother. She was that at one point. This house has turned her into something else. Someone who is willing to poison little girls and boys with rat poison. And in the present day, willing to have her son shoot up with rat poison. This is kind of nitpicky because the whole show is so pulpy and weird that, you know, you gotta let things, I guess, stretch once in a while, but I'm pretty sure if you shoot up with rat poison, there's no coming back from that.
Well, there's also no such thing as ghosts, so I'm willing to give
a little leeway
with reality.
It's when you broach the, when it, because it is so closely connected to him shooting up heroin and stuff like that, which is a real serious thing, and then you go, oh no, now he's shooting up with rat poison. I'm like, oh, that's... You could just have it be heroin, and I'd feel okay, because then it could just be ODing on heroin, and you could come back from that. When you rat poison, not good for you, I think. Not terribly...
Dr. Robbie says, rat poison, not good for you.
Hey, I am not a scientist, I am not a doctor, but I'm fairly certain putting rat poison in your veins, very bad. Very, very bad. I mean, that little girl... But Abigail, is that actually Abigail, or is that just, that's okay, that's the other question for me. The caretaker's daughter.
Mm-hmm.
That's a real person. That's Abigail. Why does everyone act like young Luke is a crazy person for thinking that the caretaker's daughter isn't real, or is real?
Because they have never seen her, because you have that monologue from Mrs. Dudley in the same episode where she's like, I homeschool her, I keep her away from the family and so forth and so on. You get the sense that she's very private about her children, and that Luke is somebody who's prone to making up stories and seeing things in the dark. So I don't know. I bought that twist pretty reasonably that somebody, oh yeah, she's in old timey clothes and I see her out in the forest. Yeah, sure, Luke. Go ride your pink elephant to go see her out there. I don't know. I bought that twist.
I think the past parents are bad parents.
The Dudleys?
No. Well, I mean, yes. Also. But, I mean, primarily the Cranes. They're kind of, they're very busy, but their kids are like, I am seeing walking nightmares every night. And there's like, oh, you're just having, it's just a dream, honey, go back to sleep. Maybe after 5, 6, 7, 8 times, maybe take it seriously. Maybe there's something wrong. I'm not saying there's ghosts, but I'm saying maybe your child needs to see a doctor.
Well, I would argue that one of the laudable things about the show is that I think its take on Olivia and Hugh is that they are well-meaning but very flawed parents, even before the mental illness starts creeping in.
If I wake up in the night with my wife holding a screwdriver to my throat, Hugh is very forgiving, I guess. Because
I mean, but he also doesn't. Olivia cries out for help. She says straight up, "I think there's something wrong with me." And his solution is, "Hey, why don't you go stay with your sister for a while?" he's not. There, nobody's blameless in this thing. I mean, I take that back. I think there are some people who are blameless, but certainly none of the adults are.
No, I well, most of the. Most everybody's pretty flawed to varying degrees. They all are holding their own secrets to a certain extent. I think Nell is probably the most innocent, even though she does still make plenty of mistakes. But it's more understandable mistakes, and the only one who pays for them are her, really.
Mm.
None of the other family members end up, you know, Luke steals. Makes people buy drugs for him on the street. Theo is
she puts up walls.
Yeah, she does do that. They all do. I know we're not supposed to like Shirley, I guess, because she's like the tight ass. But I really don't like Shirley.
I got nothing in particular against Shirley. I mean, again, I honestly. The character who I hate in this show is Steven. Steven is the only person whose monstrousness doesn't have a justification to me. Surely you can read her and be like, yeah, she ended up having to be in some ways a de facto mom to her younger siblings. She was the person expected to hold it all together. And she goes too far in that and is not necessarily very forgiving in it. And that doesn't make her a sympathetic character at all times, but people aren't sympathetic at all times. And I think the things that occasionally make her unsympathetic are understandable and justified. And so I guess even if I didn't love the character at every moment in the show, felt like I understood the character at every moment in the show and could understand the choices that she made and the person that she became.
No, I mean, I don't mind her. Choices. Now, I don't want to say that she's badly written. I just didn't like her. That's just me going.
Wouldn't want to have a beer with her.
No, I definitely. I like Steven.
Steven is a monster.
Why is he? What is the thing that he's? Why? Because he yells at his dad?
No, that is not why. Steven is a monster because he lets his wife believe that maybe they'll have kids, and if they just keep trying, that will happen someday. Lets her want that. Lets her get engaged, get married, all of these other things, without him bringing up the fact that, no, not only do I not want that, but I have prevented that from being something that's possible, and yet I'm going to pretend otherwise and fill you with false hope for years over it.
To be fair.
That is sociopathic.
I mean, I would not call it. I would say that it was a bad decision that led to more bad decisions, and as that mountain of bad decisions grew behind him, he just left it behind him and never revealed it until he does. Remember, in the happy part at the end of the episode, his wife's like, oh, that's okay.
Doesn't matter that you lied to me and gave me false hope of a child for our entire time together.
I mean,
water off a duck's back.
To be fair, it is. It's not like they can't have kids in the future. It is his. He can reverse the what do you call it? The snip snip.
Vasectomy.
Yeah, yeah.
That's not the problem. The problem isn't the that lie. He got the vasectomy. Even honestly, if he had just never mentioned it and then, you know, brought it up at some point in their relationship when they started talking about having kids, it would be bad. It would be very bad, but not monstrous. What's monstrous is to let your wife think that you are trying for a child while the entire time you know that that is not going to happen and do that for years. That is, I stand by that being sociopathic.
I think my opinion on Steven largely was formed well before that was revealed, which is like episode 7, 8. It's very late in the show when you actually find out that stuff. I mean, that's not true. That's kind of true for most of the characters. I mean, Luke, you know, right away, he's an addict. That's revealed really early on. The mistakes of him, his problems, Theo's general kind of apathy towards people. Shirley's kind of hyper controlled thing, her also anger at all her siblings. And, you know, I think my opinion on Steven is largely like he was the dude who wrote a book and everyone's really pissed at him for doing that. And I don't know. That's the thing I focused on that and said, oh, look, that's what I really formed of Steven more than the I hid my vasectomy from my wife thing. Which is bad. No, I'm not. But it feels like I think it's weird to me that they reveal that so late. It's like they are forming. Do you think they're trying to like push the audience towards liking or disliking the different brothers and the different kids? Or is it just like, oh, well, some people like this one because they're like them and this person will like them because they're like them. We don't have to worry about that.
I do think there's characters that the show has more sympathy for than others. Again, I think you're right to point out that Nell feels like an innocent here, the person who suffers the most through the least fault of her own. And that to a certain extent, there's other characters where they want you to be enraptured by the character in some way or to be suckered in by what the character does or how the character seems to feel. But I don't know if there's a necessarily a strong impulse in terms of like story choices beyond, again, kind of isolating Nell and giving her a siloed tragedy to put you on one person's side or another.
Her poor husband.
That's Nell, I assume you're referring to?
Yes. I mean, all of them. Yeah. I could say it about any of the husbands. It's none of them.
there's no great husband. No. I mean, that's, yeah. Or there's no great marriage in this show.
I mean, he just seemed like a pretty solid dude.
I will say it's maybe not to this level, but the opening 10 minutes or 15 minutes of the Nell episode feel pretty on par, or at least in the same ballpark as Up for me. For like, oh, here's a love story and tragedy in the span of, you know, just a quarter of an episode. And my heart's broken. The world is cruel and full of pain.
Oh, yeah, it's rough. That episode is not afraid of going in on, like, horribleness, and the fact that she is in the middle of like a what do you call them, night terror, and suddenly her husband just falls over dead 3 steps from her, you know, from a quote-unquote aneurysm. Yeah, right, doctor, am I supposed to believe that? The bent neck lady got her.
It's clearly ghosts.
It's clearly the bent neck lady. He following Nell around and she's like, Nell can't be happy, I'm going to murder her husband right in front of her when she can't do anything to stop me. Still.
What medical school did you go to? Yeah.
I went to ghost school. I don't know. I like Nell a lot. Nell's a good character. Is she? That's the other question. Why is she like screaming out in the middle of a car ride? Is it just because they're arguing?
One of the things that I like about the ghosts in this show, even if I don't love the scares necessarily, and I guess that's a jump scare too. Maybe that's, is that the one traditional jump scare I'm thinking of? Anyway,
it's very prominent. Like they're just arguing, like, because, and they set it up. Like, I understand, like, it makes quote unquote sense to put it there because the audience is in like kind of a lull and there hasn't been a scary part for a bit because it's just like they just had a conversation between Hugh and Steven in the car ride, and then there's a parallel car ride between with Theo and Shirley, and they're like they're having another conversation and the church did no argument, but you're still like, oh, this is normal family yelling, not haunted spooky yelling, and then they're like, ah, gotcha, ah.
How horrifically unexpected.
Oh, it scared me. I guess.
But one of the things that I like about the ghosts in the show is they seem, at least some of them seem disoriented, seem to not quite understand what's going on. And particularly for Nell, who is a depending on how you want to perceive the time stream in this show, a relative new addition to the world of the damned. You could see her trying to break through, trying to communicate to her family members and not necessarily being able to do that in a clear, coherent way. So I at least buy the logic behind it, even if I'm a little more lukewarm on the like, hey, no, we're talking about serious family stuff. And wow, no!
How does that time skip stuff work for you?
It does. It definitely does. I liked... In fact, again, I think that's one of the things that I liked best about the ghost stuff is more the structure of it than the actual spooky things that they went for. Like, I like the idea. I know this is going to be a lesser making quality for you, but it feels a little Twin Peaks to me that the time doesn't necessarily line up well, or it doesn't necessarily line up linearly. And because of that, it does make the ghost world seem a little more distinct and a little more hard to discern and get your hands around, which makes it feel genuinely different and genuinely supernatural in a way that just like, oh, I'm a ghost now and I obey all the other laws of time and physics, but just, you know, I wear spooky dresses and scream sometimes. Would do.
Spooky dresses. I like it. I like it. I mean... Again, this is just was an interview, so I didn't really pick up on this from the show, but apparently Nell, like the time stuff was supposed to be particular to Nell in particular, I guess, because she had like, you know, the fact that Olivia was clearly like had latent psychic ability of some sort. They kind of allude to that strongly near the end with her talking about stones and volcanoes exploding in her presence, but those ability, you know, and they leaked down to her kids, and like, you know, you see it more clearly in Theo because she touches people and she touches things and she feels stuff, but apparently Nell is sees through time or something. Like that's what one of the interview with Mike Flanagan, he kind of alluded to that. But
do we get that before she dies?
I mean, we get the part where she sees the bent neck lady, which is...
But everybody's seeing ghosts.
I mean, but the bent neck lady is a specter out of time, which is herself out of time. So I don't know, honestly. I didn't notice that. Like,
seems
I didn't pick up on it.
Seems a little circular to me.
Well, I mean, also the last episode, Steve sees the younger version of his father walking around and encountering all the stuff. And I don't know if that's just a product of the house versus a product of, like, being able to time warp.
Well, it feels like there's other instances in which, like, and maybe it's just the when you're inside the house, time doesn't work the way it's supposed to. But, you know, in one scene, they'll be jiggling on the door and then it'll jiggle on the other side at a different time. Though maybe that's just, you know, people not realizing they're inside the red room. It feels like there was more playing with the timeline than just with Nell, but maybe that's a response to the fact that they do some interesting things in terms of editing and depositing half of one scene in one episode and giving you the other half of it in a different episode or something like that. So maybe I'm mixed up, but
yeah, I mean, I think they purposely, I think that's actually the editing of the show. Like I take away the, you know, including certain characters can do certain things, and then sometimes it doesn't matter, and everyone can do anything. But I think the editing, the way that they structure the show, structure the story, and how they make the climaxes line up, the dueling, because there's the two timelines basically, and they structure the show so that we get both climaxes kind of in the last episode, technically, with them all back at the house, and then the first climax is when they leave the house, and the mystery, which you write about, you know, they manage to reveal those mysteries, I think, in a fair way. There is never a moment where I go, oh, I feel cheated, or I don't know what's happening. I feel like I'm getting a steady enough supply of answers with those questions. And at the end, there's really not real questions left. I think they answer pretty much everything.
Yeah, they shortcut some stuff, but they answer pretty much everything. And that feels so rare. Like, it shouldn't. It doesn't seem like it should be that big of an achievement at the end of the day. But the truth is that it is. You have this show, and it gives you these mystery boxes, but it leads you to them. It doesn't just fumfer along for four episodes, and then, bam, here's the crazy twist that changes everything. And well, we'll thump for along for another four more episodes, and boom, here's the finale, and now you know everything. Like it spoon feeds the audience little by little what builds up to those climaxes, to where when it happens, it's for the most part satisfying and fair. And it lets you get to know the characters in between the time while that's happening, rather than filling up the time in between big reveals with just generic wheel spinning and I don't know. It seems unfair to compare it to Castle Rock, which was one of my big complaints about that show. But I think that's true of a lot of shows where they have these big reveals but don't really know how to fill the space in between them. And one of the best things about Haunting of Hill House – I was about to say House on Haunted Hill. One of the best things about this show is the way that it – A – fills in the answers to the questions gradually, and yeah, it puts in a big piece of the puzzle at the end, but doesn't just keep everything until the major climaxes. And also that it does the character work in between. It gives you these spotlight episodes for each character to let you get to know them, to let you understand their psychology and their damage, so that when those big climaxes do happen, it means something, and it's not just this crazy twist for twist's sake that nobody cares about because you don't care about any of the characters in the story.
You mentioned Castle Rock. I mean, we did, you know, it's another horror show. Also, was it also 10 episodes? I think it was.
It felt like 30, but no, it was only 10.
I was about to swear, there was 15 in that. There had to be, because it felt so long, because there was a bunch of scenes that weren't necessary and didn't do anything in that thing. And this, I don't know, I would say I might criticize the every, like, certain individual episodes might have a little bit of too much, like, you know, a minute or two or five that I would say, hey, maybe, you know, move it away, move it to a different place, because certain episodes are like 40 minutes long and the finale is an hour and 10, and you're like, that's a big swing between the two. But I guess it's the benefit of having it on Netflix. You can just kind of do, oh well, we want this end to end here, this is a big story beat, we want to end it right here, and we can worry about the extra later.
I say there's at least, I would say most of the shows, pardon me, most of the episodes are at least 50 minutes long. I think there's one that dips down to 42, but pretty much all of the rest of them, I'm almost positive, are at least 50 minutes a piece. And some of them are, you know, an hour and 10 minutes.
Yeah, maybe not have a bunch of people like having birthday or not sobriety cake, I suppose. Is that that ending?
Who doesn't enjoy a good sobriety cake?
I mean, I like cake. You don't have to sell me on cake. I am on board. I got it. I am a fan. I won't care the situation. Whatever reason you're serving me cake, I am taking that plate from you.
I have managed to stay off heroin my entire life. Where is my cake?
Never. Not once have I done heroin. I want a cake. Where's my...
Give me my no heroin cake.
My never heroin cake.
Should be bigger than Luke's.
Luke had it. Yeah, I mean, his cake wasn't that big, to be fair. It was a pretty small cake.
It's bigger than mine.
It's to be true. That's, I mean, you have no cake, so any cake is bigger. Even a cupcake would be bigger. Okay, this is a nitpicky thing. I did not like young Luke.
I disagree with that wholeheartedly. I love young Luke. I thought both the kids were pretty good actors and B, pretty adorable.
I like all the kids. I don't like young Luke. I think it's just those glasses. It feels manipulative.
Another plank in the long-held platform of Robbie's anti-glasses, especially on kids' beliefs.
I mean, those glasses are huge. You mentioned up. They're like the size of, is it Carl? Is that the name of the character?
Carl is the name of the grandpa character.
Yeah, the grandpa. They're as big as him, and he's an old man. And that little kid's got these big Coke bottle glasses, and he's just like, oh, I want to play with Abigail. And he looks up at the adults, and he's got the big big telescope eyes, and you're just like, oh, God. He's going to be a heroin addict. Why are they doing this to me?
That's why they're doing this to you, Robbie.
I understand that, but I shouldn't be having that thought. It should be seamless. I'm thinking the whole time like, well, they're making this kid extra cute because he does heroin later. They want me to make.
All the kids are pretty cute, and all of them have pretty not great stuff happening.
I mean, I would say
it's just Nell, the nature of the beast.
Little Nell, little Luke are cute. All the other kids, whatever. They're kids. They're not. They're fine, but they're kind of annoying.
You should marry Steven.
Hey, I think there's a reason that me and Steven get along for the most part, all right? I'm not saying I agree with any of his life choices, but I'm saying that I understand, like, frankly, the fact that he is the one who is willing to yell at his own dad, where, like, yes, he is bought in, hey, there are no ghosts, because that's the rational thing to do that makes you not go crazy. Like, I understand. That makes sense.
And also, it sounds crazy if this is nominally set in the real world, and you're a kid, you can't trust your recollections.
Right. And so he's like, okay, there's no such thing as ghosts. All I know is that I got pulled out of the house, along with all my siblings, in the middle of the night, pulled out of bed by my dad. He wouldn't answer any questions about my mother. I find out later that she's dead. He comes back covered in blood. He goes off with the police, and then we move and live with our aunt. And
I'm going to grow up to be super well adjusted.
Yeah, everyone has various problems. So when he's like, hey, Dad, you should have did something other than nothing, other than go stay with your sister for a bit. I'm like, he's right. He should have done something. His wife has clear mental issues, regardless of if you believe it has something to do with the house or not. You don't go, how about you abandon the house flipping project and you move the entire family out somewhere else? They stay in a hotel while you work on the house during the day. Like Beardy Helper Guy says, hey, we don't go in the house at night because it worked out. It worked out that we don't go in the house at night. We feel better now.
He has a name. It's Mr. Dudley. Beardy helper face. Helpy beard face. I'm not sure what order that
did
was
they in. Mr. Dudley, I don't like either of the Dudleys either. They're bothersome. They're creepy. I would have gone, no thank you, I don't want you helping. Go somewhere else. Go away.
I like Mr. Dudley because this show is chock full of overwritten, florid monologues, and he is one of the few characters in the show who can deliver them with aplomb.
I guess that's fair. Again, this is not criticizing the acting, because I think largely all the actors do a great job, and oftentimes they do a great job with sometimes questionable writing.
Shaky at best is how I would describe the dialogue. I mean, that's the thing. Sometimes when you have characters having actual conversations, whether it's the rapport of the actors or that it's easier to write exchanges than it is to write these sort of overdone speeches that populate this show. It comes out very well, I think. I think it's episode 6 where they're all in the funeral home having these conversations back and forth. It has, by all accounts, should be totally strained and totally contrived. And at times it is, but for the most part, there's an ebb and flow of a big family argument that feels pretty truthful to me. And at the same time, one of the reasons that I don't mind the kids is it feels like the interactions between the parents and their children are true to life in a lot of ways. There's some, yes, kids being annoying, but also kids being adorable in ways that feel real and lived in to an extent, like a real family. But good Lord, there's just so many times where somebody is sitting and maybe not looking directly at the camera, but looking just like a little ways off the camera while it slowly zooms in on their face. And they say something like, "Oh, I remember the time that thing happened. The rain came down like a hail of bullets out of nowhere. I wore a red dress that had the crimson color of a flushed face." You know, you're just like, nobody talks like that. And I don't necessarily love that criticism for dialogue, because art has a right to be aspirational and unrealistic and mannered in a way that doesn't necessarily have to be a perfect mirror to human speech. But it was just so strained so much of the time that it is, for me, honestly, the biggest pitfall of this series as a whole, is the way that the show falls back time and time again on characters giving these grandiose speeches that are supposed to underline the themes or recount some representative vignette that just, I can see Mike Flanagan or his collaborators sitting at a laptop typing this out, going like, I'm writing my op-ed and having my character say it, as opposed to having it come out naturally the way that it feels would feel more organic to the story that the show is telling.
I do think that scene where, before we realize Steve's in the red room, when he's writing and he's like, "Oh yeah, I just got 2 pages done today," and he's reading it aloud, and he's like, "Oh, this is too wooden." And then his actual writing kicks in and he's like, "Yeah, I came home and blah." I'm like, okay, I understand. This is the writers. This is just what they did when they were trying to write this show. That's all that happened.
It can use another draft or two, Steve.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, that is his first draft. I will cut him some slack. Although that is the effective part. I really enjoyed that opening of the last episode. Like, as the last episode wears on, it gets depreciably worse, but that opening, it's just like, oh, his wife's pregnant and he's writing the sequel to his book and everything's fine now. I'm like, oh, he's in the red room, this is all. And then he realizes it right after I do, and I think I appreciated that. I think I can forgive the writing probably more than you can, because I think some of it, I'm not going to excuse all of the kind of bad monologues, but some of it I can excuse because of the fact that it is Gothic horror, and Gothic horror is built kind of upon purple prose and Edgar Allan Poe and Mary Shelley and thing. Like, it doesn't work as well in dialogue, but you can't have, like, they can't, you know, there's no narrative, there's no narration to, like, go, oh, and the, I mean, they shoehorned it in, and that's,
if only there was some kind of voiceover where you could put all of your monologues and subject your audience to them whenever you felt like it.
I mean, they do.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah, like, it's. I'm not going to say it's the worst part, but it's a consistently bad offender when they do that.
So, I think that is them trying to evoke that. I don't know if it is. I glossed over it. I think that is it. I think tells you how well paced the show is, and how it isn't, I never stopped at the show and went, what? Like there wasn't a 5 or 10 minute period where I go, what is, why? Like, I never went, why is this here? What am I watching? Why is this going on? Probably until that music kicks in the last bit, but up until that point, I was engaged, even when things faltered here and there, because I think overall the show is very good, and it made me think about how we connect mental illness to horror. I think it's an interesting thing, and I think it's a thing that's being examined more and more. It's certainly not the first time it's happened, but I think it's more cogent messages now because of the fact that we're a little bit more enlightened about mental illness, and having it elucidated more and more, I think, in horror is a good thing. Horror is a good place to explore mental illness, but this is like the right way to do it. This is the right way to say, look, this is how families will struggle at times with when they have family members that have mental illness of some sort. They're fighting it, and you are like, there are very effective scenes that have nothing to do with ghosts, where it's people struggling to deal with family members who they love and they want to help, but they are also like people. When Nell goes to Steven's book reading and just starts screaming at him in the middle of a book reading, and I'm like, I understand why you'd be angry. Or Luke, you know, the various things that Luke does to people, where they're like, I want to help you, but you're also, this is not, it's going to end up hurting you more. I don't know. You don't know what to do. There's no right answer. And I think that's always a good source of conflict. And when you highlight that in the same way, they don't do the thing where they go, oh, they're crazy, so they see ghosts. They might be crazy, but there are also ghosts. They're real, sort of.
Are there a lot of works that do they're crazy, so they see ghosts?
I mean, it's as we've gotten closer. I feel like it was just, I think it's closer connected to classically, like, women's insanity, basically. A woman goes crazy, and so something bad happens. It's not nearly as often as a man. When a man goes crazy, he's like a slasher villain, basically.
It's Jack Torrance.
Yes, exactly. When a woman goes crazy, it's a woman. She went crazy. She's a problem thing. And there's not a lot of horror about that, but it's certainly a trope in fiction in general. But it can be. There's certainly a lot of horror where the villain is literally just a person with mental illness, nothing more, nothing less, and it's like not that exciting.
I guess that's the thing. I think there's a lot. I didn't necessarily love the depiction of. Scratch that. In fact, edit the mumbling out.
Okay.
I like the depiction of mental illness in Haunting of Hill House. In particular, I think Carla Gugino. Do you know how to pronounce that, Robbie?
It's either that or Gugino. So you're half a 50-50 shot.
All right, fingers crossed. I think she does a really good job at portraying Olivia as being a real person who is going through something and slipping into this. I think that performance is very good, and a lot of the baggage that the family deals with from mental illness is well established and well done. I don't necessarily love the way that the show tries to connect or unite the horror and mental illness aspects of it. I don't think the union of those two things is necessarily very good. Maybe it's just because sometimes the show writes it on the screen by having Steven yell at his dad about it. But I guess I think of Hereditary and movies like The Babadook, and even a show like Buffy the Vampire Slayer that has done the, like, are supernatural things happening or is this person just lost their mind kind of trope. And I think dredged a lot more out of the connection between the two. I think House – why can't I say the title of this movie? The Haunting of Hill House is – good at setting up some interesting horror stuff, or at least some interesting ghost story stuff, and is good at setting up some interesting family drama in terms of processing mental illness. But I don't know if I ever love the way that it ties the two of them together, at least not as much as I've loved the way certain other works have tied those two things together.
And I think I always look at it like, I don't know, my broad definition of horror is pretty broad. And like, I think the show functions as horror because sometimes the family stuff is the horror. I mean, without the ghosts, with zero ghosts. And like, people often describe that as family drama versus, you know, straight horror. But when Nell, I think it's particularly effective in the Nell episode because Nell is going to a psychiatrist and she's like explaining, hey, this is what I've seen, this bent neck lady, blah, blah, blah. I've seen her all my life. She's popped up here and there. My husband has just died, and I feel like I can't escape the feeling that she was responsible. But there's a particular, like, she's like, no, I know you don't believe me. No one's ever believed me. And I think that is one of the lines that stuck with me. And it's about, you know, because she's always going to go seeing things that aren't there and always had, like, I think Steven talks about her phases, which, you know, we don't see. You know, we only see really two times in all these character lives. We see the modern day and we see them when they're kids. And so we don't know, but he talks about her Christian phase and her like new age phase and like all these phases she's gone through. And I don't know, it's not quite, you know, just horror. There's also just kind of terrific sadness and all that because she's looking for answers and she never finds them. And no matter what she tries, no one believes anything she says. And no one is even willing to make the leap that I believe that you believe that to a certain extent. It feels like her family has kind of abandoned. They've all abandoned each other, really. Aside from, like, I think, you know, Shirley does let Theo live with her in the beginning of the show. There's that. So give Shirley credit for that. But everyone else is kind of...
They're all estranged from each other. They're blocking this out. They don't want to have to deal with these things. They're too hard to deal with, whether it's confronting their past or confronting each other.
This is a practical question that I'm not sure. Are we supposed to have like a specific time period that the child portion is set in?
So there's a line that Nell says to her psychiatrist, who is incidentally played by Russ Tamlin, who A, played a psychiatrist in Twin Peaks, and B, was also apparently in the 1960s adaptation of Shirley Jackson's book. So there's some nice continuity there. Mm-hmm. But I think she says to him that these events happened, or he says to her, happened 26 years ago. That's the time frame, or at least the distance between the past and the present. So, you know, assuming that the scenes we see where they're all adults are set in the present day, that would put it at, you know, 1990, 1992, thereabouts.
And she, I mean, there is, I guess you could, I don't, I was just thinking about it. Like, why does Olivia dress like that in 1992? It feels so strange to me. Everything else seems fine, but the way she dresses, it feels like she is where she is, like in the 50s or 40s or 60s or whatever, depending on her outfit for that small bit. It just feels,
I don't know, I feel like I know people who, or at least I have known people who kind of dressed like that. Just because she just wears dresses. It's not, I don't think there's anything particularly 50s-ish about it. I'm not a fashion expert by any stretch of the imagination. But at the same time, I don't know. I guess there's a particular style, and it's almost hippie-ish to me. And I could kind of buy that from the character. Like, it's how I would, in my head, picture a spiritual person dressing to some degree.
Spiritual. Is that, you think Olivia's spiritual, not religious?
I think so. I mean, there's a that scene with her and I forget whether it's Luke or Steven where they're talking to Mrs. Dudley, where she's like, oh, you know, we gave him the Bible and the Quran and the Talmud and the, and you know.
And he's a child, so he threw them all in the garbage because he doesn't want to read those books. They're boring.
And went to the Red Room to play video games.
he went to go, oh, video games. This is much more. Mortal Kombat's way better than the Bible.
But she strikes me as somebody who is interested in spiritual exploration, probably due in no small part to the fact that she's sensitive in some ways.
She has the shine.
The twins have the shine.
They all have.
She doesn't have the shine.
She has the shine. I think it's, you know, she she feels certain things. I think she passed those on to the twins to a certain extent. It's genetic. It always is, Andrew. Come on, don't you know that?
Well, yeah, but she doesn't have the, like, I can't perceive other people's thoughts kind of thing. She's
the shine,
got,
the
got
shine,
different psychic powers.
Well, that's still the shine. The shine is not prescribed to certain psychic abilities. It could be any ability.
Fair enough. I guess I only... Because it's the only psychic ability you get in the actual Shining, right? Or I've only seen the movie. I apologize. But
no, well, actually, Andrew, if you delve into the greater Shining lore, if you read Dr. Sleep, the sequel, which is fine. they're making this.
They should have called it The Fine.
Oh God, Mike Flanagan.
I'll seek myself out.
Mike Flanagan is directing, I guess, the adaptation of Dr. Sleep next. That's his next project. So you'll have chance to watch Dr. Sleep. I have no idea how they're going to adapt that thing because that's a clumsy, weird book that young Stephen King would never have published the length that it is. Of course, that's all Stephen King's modern stuff. It's like 700 pages. Come on, Stephen King.
Are they going to bring Jack Nicholson back for it and do like a
no, he's,
old he, man Jack no, Torrance
no,
routine?
No, Torrance Jack is dead in Dr. Sleep. So both the parents.
Spooky and ghost-like.
Both the parents are dead. So,
oh, that's sad.
Yeah, well, Jack died relatively shortly after the events of The Shining. The mother lived much longer. At least a few, but the shine can be any psychic ability. It is not necessarily specifically the thing that Danny has.
Fair enough. I retract my critique.
But she's got something. She has color headaches.
Color storms, I think she calls them.
Yeah, color storms. Very, very floaty, very airy. I do want to laud myself. I immediately spotted mustache clock man.
Well, my wife was like paused to joke about it. It was like, oh, this is great. Yeah. No, did they run out of central casting and just like, yeah, give me a guy with a big wrench and a handlebar mustache.
I'm like,
we didn't process him as a ghost. We just thought it was lazy casting.
Well, it's sometimes hard to tell what's intentional and what is not. I did spot mustache man. I'm like, he don't belong. Come on. That other dude was wearing flannel. Like he just fell out of Pearl Jam. There's no way that dude is in 1992. That dude's walking around. Handlebar mustaches were not hip in 1992.
Well, and also he was a clockmaker and learned all these things about witness marks and that it's very specialized to do it. Which ties nicely into our serial podcast. So
yeah, what's his face? Mike Flanagan listened to S-Town.
That's clearly
before he started writing this adaptation. He was like, let's keep this. Let's make a note of this.
Honestly, would not shock me if it was at least partly inspired by S-Town.
It's something I would do. I would go, oh, that sounds good. Let's use that as flavor somewhere. And to be fair, Hugh is a handy guy, even though he's terrible at all the work he does on the house. He manages to do nothing right and cuts it open his hand on a fan.
Well, he needs to fix things, Robbie. Did you understand that? I'm not sure if they laid it out clearly enough.
I got it. He's a fixer. Yeah. To be fair, he is like going to therapy in the present day, at least. Which is, so they would probably, they would use the term, you're a fixer, towards him. And I think he seemed to have absorbed some of the lessons of therapy.
That's good.
I guess. I think older Hugh seems to, he's pretty level-headed considering the terrible stuff going on.
Yeah, well, older Hugh is pretty sympathetic, I think. I mean, you clearly understand that he's made bad choices and to some extent continues to make bad choices, but he seems... well-meaning, and again, I think at the end of the day, I end up gravitating to performances that I like, which can cover some of the difficulties in the way that a character is written. But the way that he kind of stops in the middle of his sentences and jumps from one thought to another felt very true to conversations that you have with certain people. And in a show where so little of the dialogue felt naturalistic and it was so riddled with those big speeches, there was a realness to when he would speak about something that helped endear me to him, endear him to me.
I liked this show. It is kind of a bummer.
It's not a fun, warm, happy show. That is for sure.
And then the problem is I go, oh, it's not really a happy show. And then the ending tries to make it happy. And I go, oh, no, I don't want this either. I don't want the happy. This is feels like it should end a little more somber. I mean, their dad just died. Shouldn't we have a little can we have a single moment for poor Hugh?
But he's going home. He's going to go be with his wife and daughter. He accepts this and he's freed his children from it to some extent.
That's my final question. Are they Nell, Liv, and Hugh? Are they like in heaven or something? Or are they still trapped in the house?
They are in the afterlife, and the house is kind of a way station or an inflection point between the realm of the living and the realm of the dead. That would be my interpretation of it.
Okay. Is the house evil?
Kind of. I mean, I think evil is too much. It's
malevolent?
A Venus flytrap. It's an anglerfish. It wants to lure you in and then gobble you up. It's just
a predator, but not necessarily, you know, a lion will kill you, but it's not necessarily evil.
Yeah, I mean, it clearly seems a little more intelligent than that, but I think it wants more people. It wants to gobble you whole and will send out its lures to try to make that happen. That's how I read it, at least.
Okay. So what is going to... Okay, they haven't announced this yet, but I assume there will be a season two of this because this show is apparently one of the most binge shows of 2018. That's what Netflix has released, I guess. I assume there'll be a season two.
Or so they say.
Or so they say, yeah. I mean, they're fairly clear when, like, if they don't say anything about a show, that's when things are bad. Because they don't just say nothing about it. Then, you know, 2 months later, it's been canceled. Because they get the raw viewership numbers.
Give me the numbers or stop boasting as far as I'm concerned.
Well, they got... You know, they got two throwing horn. No one else is going to do it.
That's fair, but I guess I'm increasingly skeptical when the only source for their boasts is them. It's again Kesha declaring that she was a genius.
I would say all you have to do to know what Netflix's ratings are is look how much money they're willing to pay the people who are in the new second season or third season of shows like Stranger Things cast. Look at the pay raises they got for season 2 and 3, and tells you how well that show did.
Follow the money, Robbie.
Follow the money.
Follow the money.
So what's season 2?
Season 2's got to be The Hills, right? Like they're going to go back and do the story of Poppy and her grandmother and young Mrs. Dudley and all that. That would be my bet. I don't necessarily want that. I don't necessarily think we need that. Frankly, I don't think there should be another season of the show. And that's not a complaint. Like I thought the show was good, and I'm perfectly content to see that creative team do something else. Maybe it's just an anthology kind of series. Like it's not The Haunting of Hill House. Maybe the next is the, I don't know, Spooking of Still Slope or something, but just not centering everything on the same location. But if you're going to do it, I don't know how that doesn't become season 2, how it's not shifting in time and trying to do the same thing with a new set of characters in a different time frame.
Well, Mike Flanagan is on the record saying he believes the Crane's family story is complete. So that would lead me to believe that if they did a season 2, it would probably not be focusing on the Cranes, but hey, what if Hill House was a bed and breakfast?
I mean, are we going back to Castle Rock now?
But in an anthology story where every episode a new person visits Hill House, we delve into their horrible, horrible life, and they see terrible, terrible ghosts, and then they either leave or die.
I mean, that's true for most houses, right?
I guess that's fair. But this is a much shorter abbreviated timeline than, I guess, a person's typical experience with a house because they'll be there for a few nights at most. And maybe you bring back one of the cast or two of the cast from, and they run the place. Like, Steven owns the place now. Maybe Steven's, like, the spooky caretaker and he's wearing... I can't. This is the thing I actually absolutely cannot excuse. There is no, like, I'm not going to mince words about this. The makeup on the Dudleys at the end.
Oh, no, it was terrible.
It was so bad. Why is that?
Ironically, it reminded me of the old age makeup that was put on Carla Gugino in the Watchmen movie that I found very unconvincing.
Let's not talk about the Watchmen movie.
We can talk about the makeup. It's relevant.
Okay. It's so that movie.
Package it for another podcast.
You want to talk about blue movies? I think you mentioned that in your review about how this thing is like blue gray all day long. God, Watchmen's just that color palette, the Zack Snyder color palette. Blech.
I think that's actually the official term for the color grading that Zack Snyder uses on his movies.
We want this to look like nothing. We want it to look like filth. We just want it to look like garbage. Pull it out of that trash can. Oh, this Superman movie. You can almost see what's going on. Well, rub a smear of garbage all over the film before you release it. Oh, that looks much better. I can't see anything now. Perfect. Zack Snyder.
But that's the thing about Haunting of Hill House is I don't necessarily love the color grading, and it does kind of give you that cool blue way too often, or that muted blue way too often. But every once in a while, there'll be a really cool framing of a particular shot or a particular scene. Or the episode 6 where you have all those long extended shots. Like, there's a ton of creativity in the cinematography there. And you can see the visual potential of the show, which in some ways makes things like, oh yeah, we're just, when we don't know how a scene should be lit, we're just going to do that muted blue. Or, oh, they're supposed to be old Dudleys now, so give them a Santa Claus beard. Like, the fact that they can do good things visually seems to make it more frustrating when they don't.
Yeah, they tip over the edge to kind of ludicrous at certain points. I don't care about the Dudleys. I just don't. Like, I don't understand why they're in there at the end at all. You didn't need them. I
like the idea of that scene. they're reuniting with their daughter. It's that sense of reunion, that sense of families coming back together after tragedy. I think there's good thought process behind it. The execution is not great.
The Dudleys are. I also think no one should be. They should never have last. No one should have the last name of Dudley.
Is that your wrestling fandom coming through, or is that just something entirely independent?
I don't know. It just doesn't feel. It feels like such a nothing name. Like, I don't ascribe anything.
I'm sorry. Let me apologize to anybody listening to this podcast whose actual last name is Dudley.
No, I mean, like, when you, I think, you know, when you see the names of characters, I think they should stand out. You should, and you, when you give a character, when you give them a name of Dudley, it's just like, it's a real name, and it's a fine name. There's nothing wrong with people named Dudley, but these are fictional characters. When I look at a character's name, it should evoke something.
I will say, you know, Mr. and Mrs. Dudley doesn't do a lot for me. But maybe it's just the delivery. When young Hugh is talking to the police or talking to the lawyer and is like, no, the Dudleys can stay. Like, there's something about it that it's like, oh, yeah. The caretakers of the old hill place, Mr. and Mrs. Dudley. Yeah, the Dudleys are there. They look after the place when no one's around. You know, like there's something about the Dudleys makes it sing a little bit more to me.
Devon, get the tables. Is there anything else in your notes that we haven't covered, Andrew?
Let me think here for a sec. I feel like there was something, but I can't dredge it up now.
Oh, no. Dredge it up. Like ghosts from the past?
let me ask you a question, Robbie. What did you think of Theo's empathic touch powers? How did you like that?
I think, just like some other parts of the show, I think in parts were very good, very well crafted, restructured, works well in the context of the show. And then other parts, a little heavy-handed. Maybe I understood after the second time you told me. you don't have to lay it on so thick. Maybe you don't have to show like a camera shot at the very end of the show. Like, look, she leaving her gloves behind. Eh? Eh? Get it?
We've got to put a button on every story that happened to show that everything was wrapped up in a neat little package.
No, the button.
That's how life and stories work.
The buttons were Nell's thing, not Theo's.
Touche, Robbie. Touche.
I think there's, they are a little bit, I question everything now about the subtlety of things, because I know after I finished watching it, I was Googling around and like multiple articles, here's what the ending of The Haunting of Hill House meant. I'm like, was anyone confused by it? This isn't Castle Rock with, like, nebulous nonsense. This is a fairly concrete ending we saw. Like, it's very clear what happens to everyone. I won't fault the show for that, for literally spelling out, literally, here, every cast member, aside from, like, the cop. That's the only person we don't get an ending for, really. Everyone else, like, they get their little ending, whatever it may be. Maybe people just don't pay attention.
Or maybe there's something to be said for wanting to explain what it means, even if explaining what happens is less clear. Again, I think the show skips over a lot of stuff from where the final night in the Hill House ends and when you get all these epilogue scenes in the montage there. Like, it just kind of yada, yada, yada is over a lot of important stuff where you could go like, hey, wait, how does that happen? I mean, even the Theo thing, I'm sitting there going like, huh, okay, well, even if you're in a better place emotionally and psychologically, if you literally had empath powers, it would still be really damn inconvenient to have to feel the history of every single time you picked up a spoon or brushed somebody's hand on the street. Like, I could see people having questions about like, wait a minute, what happened there? How does that work? Because the show sometimes is like, let's give you a happy ending, and we haven't necessarily fully built to that, and we're just going to show it, so
I mean, when
enjoy!
When all those happy endings happen, I immediately just assumed, like, it's the best version available, so she now can control her powers, and they only happen when she wants them to.
Sure, why not? But
I mean, that's
nobody says that, and there's never any indication one way or another.
I know, but I don't... When it went to happy ending mode, I immediately turned my brain off, because that's... I immediately went, oh, that's the end of the show. I don't worry about all this. I'm concerned with everything before this. This might as well not have happened at all.
But it's a big, important thing. Like, it's Theo's curse in a lot of ways, and it's just gone. I'm willing to accept the idea that there was the catharsis of confronting this experience, and she's able to control it now, or maybe it even went away, but... I don't feel like the show sets that up in a particularly good way, so I guess I will brook some confusion on that point.
I mean, I hate to break it to you, but Rogue of the X-Men also has touching powers. They're changing that around too, Andrew.
Is nothing sacred anymore, Robbie?
Actually, I think they're making her a better character, honestly, if all the rumors are true. So I'm not complaining.
Did she go to a childhood haunted house and have
she married Gambit.
Emotional experience?
That's what happened. She married Gambit.
Well, I mean, he has crazy touch powers too. Maybe they can figure out their crazy touch powers to neutralize each other somehow.
I think they're changing her powers so that she doesn't have to touch people to absorb their powers. She can just do it.
Interesting. Does she have to be... Well, we...
I assume...
We can have our deep dive into Rogue at a later time.
I have no... I don't have any other context for... I have not read... there's so many comics. I cannot read all the X-Men comics. I just don't have I limit my Gambit intake on purpose.
It's good for one's health. I hear Cajun food can be heartburn.
Mon ami, share.
Mon ami, Shelly.
God. I don't have anything else to say.
I only have more cheesy Cajun accents to do, so it's probably a good sign to shut it down.
I think the show is good. I'll watch season two. Whatever it is, whenever it comes out, if it ever comes out, I'll watch it. I'll give it a shot. I think it earned it. I think this is the right kind of adaptation. This is the kind of adaptation that interests me when you take the themes of something and you twist it and make it a different thing while still, you know, the works of Shirley Jackson certainly do dwell on family history and stuff like that. So I think this is the best. If they're going to make A Haunting of Hill House, this is, I think, ideal, frankly.
I agree with that. I like the approach of keeping in the spirit of the original work, but doing something new and different with it. And it's considering how name value, name recognition value, and franchise obsessed studios are these days, I feel like that's the best thing we can hope for from current adaptations, is to take the idea and push it in a new direction so that you get something new, even if it has a familiar label.
Absolutely. Andrew, where can they find all the things you create on the internet?
People can find all the things I create on the internet at my website, which is theandrewblog.net. It's three words, theandrewblog.net. You can also find my writing as part of the expanded film and TV coverage of consequenceofsound.net. And you can always find me on Twitter at theandrewblog. And as always, Robbie, it is fun to get to talk TV shows and horror and pros and cons of all this stuff with you. Thank you for letting me invade your podcast yet again.
Well, thank you for joining me, Andrew. And that's, I think that's what I'm going to say. Thank you for joining me.
Thanks again to Andrew for joining me. You can find me on Twitter at Robbie Dorman. And the show's website is serofanaticist.com. You can follow our Facebook page at facebook.com/serofanaticist. If you like the show, please give us a 5-star review on iTunes or on whatever podcast service you use. Subscribe, tell your friends, all those things. They help out. I appreciate it. Helps the show. Until next time, thanks for being a fan.